you in pain?
A little bit. So this is Ephesians lesson 5, and we're calling it Practicing Mystery. So I want us to remember the context that Paul is talking in, that he is now in the Roman world. Sometimes I think we forget that he's not in Israel. He is, you know, outside of Israel. He's probably, I'm trying to think of where he wrote, I think from Rome he wrote Ephesians. But he's talking to the Ephesians and the whole Asia area, of which Ephesus would have been the capital. But he's talking in the Roman world. And remember, in the Roman world at this time, the mystic religions are becoming really big. That's really what's overtaking the world. So that when you see Paul using the word mystery, you know he's talking to that kind of idea and trying to tell them what the truth is about mystery rather than what they're hearing in the world. So the mystery religions were promising a disembodied salvation, one where you could escape the drudgery of the day, of what was happening, of the horrible stuff that happens on earth, with special knowledge, and then you could attain a higher consciousness. They pretty much would have said that same kind of thing, where you elevate the mind and you eventually are just taken up by the divine and consumed by the divine, so that you become part of the divine. And so that within that kind of a paradigm, in that mysterious way of connecting with God, that you actually become part of God, you become consumed by God rather than what Paul is talking about, they would have viewed tribulation, any kind of hardship, you know, whether it was, you know, tearing your meniscus or, you know, somebody attacking you or, you know, cold. All of these would have been viewed as something that you just had to get through and a reminder of why you just wanted to be away from this world.
Is an example Hindu or that examples? I mean, what would be an example?
You want me to give you a real example?
Yeah.
Christianity as we practice it today. Mm-hmm. It is this idea that we go through tribulation and we just need to persevere because eventually we're going to get to heaven. Mm-hmm. So it's a very Gnostic idea. It's this idea that it's all about our belief and then finally getting to that place where we leave the world and our body behind. So it's really about, so that's where it's Gnostic. We leave the body behind. Body is not good. And the world is not good. So in Gnosticism and in mysticism, materialism is not good. So, and all of this is just, we're just waiting for this to be gone so that we can get to heaven. That's what a mystic religion is. It doesn't mean that mysticism is wrong, but you have to be careful of the Gnosticism that is within that. And this is what Paul is talking toward, is trying to tell them, I get it. We don't like tribulation. We want to be away from it. And we think that connection with God is going to eventually mean that we don't have this world to deal with. And what they would do then is they would try to escape. So the thing you wanted most is to escape tribulation, is to escape hard times. And so you would have higher thoughts to escape. I don't want to be here. And basically what mysticism does is takes you out of the present. Because I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else. So think about that even in your own life. Are there things that you do to escape what's going on? Mm-hmm. What kinds of things do you do?
Watch TV.
What's media, food? Reading, yeah.
Sleep.
Yep.
Yeah.
Shop?
Drive.
But okay. Even like things I've taught my students, you know, like when it's you're in a hard time and you're focusing on that right here, right now,
mm-hmm.
like when we, you know, focus our attention on God, like you're not taken out of it, but the perspective grows almost to that one. Like, ooh.
Okay, so Paul, so that's what Paul's going to introduce, is that rather than escaping from it, being able to look at it differently, right? So the escapism, it's really how it kind of opens up to magic, which is what we'll talk, which is what Scripture calls it. Do you know what we call magic today? Drugs. That's what magic was. So it is this opening up to escaping. It's an escapism type of a thing. Let's escape from here because tribulations are bad and body is bad, world is bad, heaven is good. So tell me that that is not what you have heard, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of our westernized mysticism in some respects. Paul wants to refute that for these people. And remember where Paul is when he writes Ephesus. He's in jail. Okay, so he's in tribulations. And he's trying to tell them. One of the reasons he needs to tell them while he's in jail is this tribulation of his is theirs as well. First of all, they share it with him in this social way, but they also look at him and go, he's there because he preached to us, because he preached to the Gentiles. It's very likely we can be in that same place. We also are going to be facing tribulation. So Paul needs to make sure that they understand tribulation correctly, so that they understand what that is and not want to escape it. He needs to redefine for them the paradigm of mystery. So anytime Paul is talking against what's going on in the culture, he's always trying to redeem what's there. Not completely dismiss it, but redeem it. Redeem mystery, because God has introduced mystery. So it can't be all bad. It's just been turned into something that is not true. But he wants to make sure that when they see him in tribulation, knowing that they're probably going to be in tribulation, that they don't get off course and that they don't get sucked into. That would be the first thing you would be sucked into, right? I'm in tribulation. Oh, here's something offering an escape. And that's a very common thing. We all get there. We all get to the place where we want to escape from that. And so for somebody in a mystery religion, they would have considered persevering in tribulation just basically a hanging on until we get to the good part. And I think we think that too. And when we talk about perseverance, I think that's what we think of, right? That perseverance is just hanging on until we get to the good place. And Paul's going to say, no, you're looking at tribulation completely wrong. I need to make sure that you understand what mystery really is. Because mystery isn't, the mystery of Christ is not leaving this world behind. Because what has Christ been doing all along? He's been restoring heaven and earth together. He's been restoring earth, not wanting to leave it behind, but that everything will come together and be restored. It's not a disembodied paradise that Jesus talks about, ever. And yet, that seems to be the first thing that we think about, right, is salvation as a disembodied paradise. We're leaving this world, and we're leaving all the horrible things about this world behind. What Paul wants them to know is the restoration of heaven and earth together, and the mystery about that actually begins with the mystery of them together, of unity, of people that were enemies being brought together. That's the beginning of restoration of heaven and earth together. So he's, all throughout Ephesians, he's going to be talking about unity and how it starts. How it starts with the unity of human beings, of humanity. And so that the salvation that's offered in the gospel is not a leaving behind, but a gathering together. It's always bringing back together everything that God has ever created. So that when they think about being able to escape, that's the opposite of what Jesus Christ offered. It's not escapism. It's bringing back together in unity. And the unity that Christ is creating within the church is actually the essence of the mystery of what Christ is being is introducing for them. And he's inviting them then to participate in this unity. So you see that it's a real paradigm shift, not only for them, but for us, right? We really have, and even if we know that that's the paradigm, we still have to shift it because we still think about that. We still think about dying and going to heaven and that being the end. And it's not. Ephesians, he told us right from the very beginning, you have an inheritance of being rulers of heaven and earth together again. That's where it's going. That's the telos of everything. And so to think about salvation as heaven is to be a mystic or a Gnostic and not a Christian as Christ brought the gospel. So that's where Paul is coming from. So he's talking against that. And I think it's very relevant today as well. In fact, the funny thing is that the book of Romans that we think about as the big doctrinal book of the church is really just an expanded Ephesians. It's really talking about unity of bringing everything back together. It's inundated. If you go read the book of Romans, you'll see that it's like, oh, this is Ephesians. This is Ephesians. This is Ephesians. Jew and Gentile over and over and over and over again because he's talking to this, not only this mystery religion, but at the time, Jew and Gentile were really at each other because it was causing division. The Jews were thrown out of Rome. Any Jew was thrown out of Rome because of the Jew-Gentile kind of conflict, yeah. Because they thought all Jews were Christians and all Christians were Jews, and it just got really messed up, and they got thrown out of Rome because of that. So we see this being a big deal, not just in the Ephesians and the Asia Minor place, but also in Rome and all over Israel as well. And I think it's very relevant for today as well. So Paul begins this chapter by saying that he is what? For this reason, I, Paul?
Prisoner of Christ.
The prisoner of Christ. Okay. Did any of you think that that was a weird way to put it? Who imprisoned him? Rome. Why doesn't he say, I'm a prisoner of Rome?
He must have known it was for God's purposes.
Yeah, exactly. What he's saying here and what he's doing for the Ephesians and for the rest of the Asian Christians is saying, Rome's not in charge. Christ is in charge. I am living in the heavenlies. I've been seated in the heavenlies. I know the perspective of the heavenlies. I know the perspective of God here. I'm a prisoner of Christ, not of Rome. Jesus is in charge. He is putting everything in submission. It's not Rome that's in charge. It's not the power of domination that's in charge. It's actually Jesus Christ. And just that twist completely shows the Ephesians a different side of what tribulation looks like. That it's not something to escape so much as to see what does God have here for us. So that it's Christ that has something here for us. I mean, it's almost going all the way back to Joseph, right? What are the last couple of verses of Genesis? Joseph, what does Joseph say to his...
What man meant for evil, God meant for good. For
exactly. Right. That's exactly what Paul is saying here. It's not Pharaoh in charge. It's not Rome in charge. It's not Satan in charge. As much power as they seem to have, it's not them in charge. It's Christ. And he's actually using this for the salvation of many people. So just that twist is a big deal for him to say that. They would have caught that because they would have expected. I mean, it would have just been, I'm a prisoner of Rome. And for him to change that announces to them that he's talking about seeing life from a different perspective. So what he does is he's going to, and I really like how Paul does this in Ephesians particularly, he's going to show them what it should be like to live according to Ephesians 1 and 2. You've been given all of this. What do you do with it? He's going to show them first. This is what I've done with it. And that's all of 3 is, this is what I've done with it, and this is what I want to happen for you, but I'm not going to ask you that yet. I'm going to show you first what I've done with this mystery that's been revealed to me, this mystery of Jew and Gentile together, this unity being the beginning of the restoration of all of the world. So the mystery revealed is that there is a harmonized unity of, remember in Ephesians 2, we found that Christ reversed the decisions to be independent by both the Jew and all humanity, right? So you remember, how did humanity choose to be independent? What did they want to use power for?
Law.
What?
The law.
That was Jew, right?
Right.
So the Jews wanted to use Satan's power of control, of dominance, to be able to fulfill the law and connect with God. Humanity didn't even know about connecting with God. They just felt like being whole would be
independence
to serve themselves. So that's how they're using their power. And Christ reverses that. Remember, we went through that last week, that reversal of when he did the temptations, when he went through the temptations in the wilderness, he reverses those choices. And in reversing those choices, he begins then the restoration process by making a new humanity, by restoring life out of death. He exposes those choices of both the Jew and the rest of humanity. He exposes those as ineffective. They didn't make them whole, right? The humanity wasn't whole by trying to serve themselves using that dominating power, but neither was the Jew, who knew that wholeness meant connection with God, but they thought they could be connected with God by using dominating power, by this strength, this, I'm going to do this. And he exposes that in order to expose them to what his life was, this life of connected power, this life of being in perichoresis union with God. He exposes that to them so that Jew and Gentile together are made one humanity. And it's important that we understand, I think sometimes, particularly here, we don't really think about Jew and Gentile here, right? Not much. But it is the antithesis of what has been wrong. It's this separation. It's separation with God always causes separation with everything else. And it was the perfect picture for Paul to use. And during this time, the Jew and Gentile were on opposite pages. It was like saying super conservative Republican and super liberal Democrat. You know, Bernie Sanders and Ben Carson. Those, and it was like, these are on opposite sides, so opposite that bringing the, I mean, it would be like saying, okay, so instead of having an election, we're going to have Bernie Sanders and Ben Carson come together and make a coalition government. Yeah.
That would be.
That's, yeah, exactly. We're thinking, yeah. No way, they couldn't even be in the same room probably. This is what he means when he keeps saying Jew and Gentile together, making one humanity, making one new being. It's bringing those absolute opposites together. They're opposite because they're separated from each other and they think the others are idiots, and they're bringing them together to make one whole human being. And that is the beginning, making that disparate separation into a union is the beginning of everything being united. That is what will restore the world, is a restored humanity. And so that's why he talks so much about Jew and Gentile, and that there was an order to it. Jew was first given, I think we talked about Jew being chosen, but chosen really to be, to show the world that you can't use that dominating power to get to God. So it's not really that great that they were chosen so much, except that they were first to be able to know that wholeness comes by connection with God. But that bringing the Jew and Gentile together is the beginning of restoration of the rest of the world. And it had to be, because the separation of man with God and man with each other was the beginning of the destruction of the world, right? Of the corruption of the world. So he has to do it that way. He takes, so what Christ has done is not only reverse our choices, makes two into one, but he makes these two into fellows. And I don't know a better word to come up with than what scripture here uses. He makes them fellows. Fellows has a definition, a connotation and a denotation of this sharing together inequality. Now, for us, we think, well, of course, they're sharing inequality. But Jew and Gentile in this Roman world, when they think of sharing, they don't think sharing equality. There was no such thing as equality in the Roman world, in the Roman Greco world. There was such a hierarchy and such social stratus that for someone who was born a Roman citizen and then someone who became a Roman citizen, they never gained the same status. So that, let's say we have someone who was born a Roman citizen, which means he or his parents were born in Rome. And then we have, which happened a lot, freed slaves, they actually gain Roman citizenship. That happened a lot. But they never acquired the same status. Those who were born Roman were always higher. Not just in how people saw them, but in their privileges as well. So even though you become a full Roman citizen, the fact that you became one and weren't born one meant you didn't have the same privileges. You had less privileges, you had less perks, and definitely less status. So in this world, this shame honor world, that was a big deal because honor was everything. And for you to have become a Roman citizen was great, but it wasn't the greatest. So there is a very stratified society here. That's what Paul's talking into. So that when he says that the Gentiles share as fellow members of the same household, as fellow partakers of the same promise, fellow heirs, that it like explodes everything they know. They don't know a society like that. That is just, how could that possibly be? How could an adopted child have the same status as a birthed child? That just never could be. They can't even understand that.
How was Paul a Roman citizen?
Paul was, because his parents were from Rome, so he lived in Tarsus. That's where he grew up. He's not an Israelite by birth. He's Jewish, but his parents were, and they think, I'm trying to think about how, so they know that they were in Rome, and remember lots of, there were, I gotta think about how many Jews, lots of Jews in Rome. So his parents were born in Rome, is what they assume, and then moved to Tarsus in Asia Minor, which was the big educational city of Rome. That's where he would have been very educated before he went to Gamaliel.
Quick question. Yeah. Do they think that this sounds too good to be true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they have trouble buying into it.
Yes, yes. Not just even buying into it, just almost, comprehending. Okay. It's like, how could that possibly be?
It's so radical.
It's so radical. How could it possibly be? And because even the Jews were like, absolutely not.
Right.
It's taken away. They're not protecting their
superiority. Remember, so the Jews, remember last week we said how the Jews felt about Gentiles. They were such pagans that they couldn't even help the birth of a Gentile woman giving birth. And yet, they also did know that as Israel, they were the light to the nations. So they have this kind of dual, like, how do we do that? So in the temple, it shows us, they have the Gentile court, but there's a 5-foot wall in between the Gentile court and everybody else. So they know that the Gentiles can have a relationship with God, but it's not in the same status as Jews. It is absolutely a lower status relationship that Gentiles can have with Jews.
I think it's the exact same way most of us feel about grace today.
Yes,
just
exactly.
Like, it's too good to be true. There has to be a couple steps that you have to take.
Right. So we create the steps.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Love the sinner, hate the sin sort of posture.
Yes. Like, yeah. Yes, 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 yes. And I think even that, so, but once we accept the grace, don't we sometimes get into this posture of, well, I wasn't that bad.
Uh-huh.
But that person, that's what they're involved in?
Or even more so thinking that someone else, their story has to look more like yours does.
Yes.
Like transformation needs to look this way.
Reading this and thinking too of the prodigal son and like the younger son being the Gentiles and the older son being the Jews and you know, in that situation too, they both thought it was too good to be true. The younger son thought, I gotta come back as a slave.
Right.
The older son.
Right.
So.
Right. And it goes both ways. So not it's too good to be true for me. But then you always flip that. Like, well, I don't know about you. You know, you kind of have to do, you kind of, like you said, you kind of have to be like me. You kind of have to be more humble. You know, so there's this tug of war between, it's too good to be true for me. Yeah, it's way too good to be true for you. You know, we have this idea here. And that's really what's coming out. And I think that's important for us to know about Ephesians. Because everything that Paul talks about in Ephesians is super radical. And we forget that it's super radical for us as well. It's super it changes that paradigm for us. And yet we're really not sure how that paradigm works. We still think, like you said, Michelle, we kind of make our own steps to get there. And what Paul is trying to show him. And I do believe this is why God chose Paul. Why he chose a man who was persecuting and killing and murdering, going around the country murdering people who didn't fit the law. And God chooses him. I mean, today, if you think about this, if you go to a church and you find out that the pastor was a murderer, what do you think?
I'd probably bow out of that congregation.
Yeah, I mean, you're first like, I don't know about this.
Society didn't let that happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And God doesn't only just let it happen. He makes sure it does happen. He chooses this. And so we have
public, too.
Very public, no secret what about. And it's so public and so radical. And it's why Paul continues to say, me, the very greatest of sinners, so that they recognize how radical everything he says is.
And it's a total 180. I mean, you have this guy who is totally legalistic and in the law, who's preaching grace. And
yes. Yeah, exactly.
That just is amazing.
And sometimes I think we do, and I'll be honest, when this happened to Chuck Colson, so this was years ago, I remember sitting in the car and we heard the radio and I turned to Bill and I said, oh, yeah, right. Who's Chuck Colson? Chuck Colson was the legal defense for the Whitewater. He was the one who kind of helped plan.
Watergate.
You know what Watergate is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. But Chuck Colson became, Prison Ministries. Huge thing. He just passed away a year ago? But I remember.
I still think it was like, oh, you just.
Right.
Parole.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So
you're
I'll, you know.
Working the system.
What?
Working the system.
Working the system, exactly. Yeah. Like saying these kind of things. What about Jane Fonda? Yeah. Uh-huh. Jane Fonda became a Christian several years ago. Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah, see? And we're all going, oh, yeah? Right?
Wow.
So this is the type of. This should be the natural. This is what we should be looking at. This radical idea of God bringing life out of death. God is not in the business of bringing life out of people who are kind of alive. Right? In fact, I mean, Paul talks about that. He didn't come for people who are well or think they're well. He came for people who are dead. So this whole paradigm shift is really important for Paul. And he says, now it's important to me, but look what I did with it. Because I know it's important, because I appreciate so much, this is what comes out of that. So that's where he's going with them, so that they might understand that these two disparate groups are forming into one. And it's not that when they form into one, that one has priority over the other. It's as if, and I don't know a lot about music, but I know that you can have two notes, completely separate notes, brought together in one chord, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes a beautiful sound, the two of them together. And here's the thing. One of them and, or the other is not dominating the other. They're both sharing the same space. And yet, there's plenty of space for each, right? They're not taking up any space, but they're sharing the same space. This is this one of these underlying ideas of the perichoresis that we find all over the place, is things like music, that we find that. And that's what he's saying to the Jews and Gentiles. You're coming together, and this is very mysterious, that the two enemies would come together to make one human being, one type of humanity. And in doing that, it gives all of humanity a new purpose, to be able to be who they were created to be, and that is reflections of God. This two into one, those two disparates, those two very separate things coming into one, gives them this new purpose of making music, of making a poem, making something beautiful, taking what was given to each of them separately, right? Two notes, very different, right? They have they're completely on a piano. They're completely different strings, and yet they can be played together and make something brand new out of them.
I can't help but think Genesis, man and woman.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That together.
And remember that because God is perichoretic union, because he's relationship, that's what everything in creation reflects, is this union, this perichoretic union of coming together, and what he is restoring all of creation to be in that perichoretic union, which is why Paul goes over and over again, Jew and Gentile together, because it's a big deal for them. And we need to understand how big of a deal that is for them to come together. So Paul says, this is what's been happening. How then do we respond to this, that God is creating new humanity for us by bringing the two separate things together? And when I bring them together, God says, they don't lose anything. Each note doesn't lose. It stays fully that note. And yet, coming together, it makes something new. So that for us, when we're brought into the perichoresis, when we're brought into the union with God and the church, we have a gift to give. We have something of our being, something unique of us to be able to share that doesn't get lost in there. That's the great thing about the perichoretic union is, as much as they are connected, their individuality, their uniqueness is not lost, right? Spirit remains spirit. Sun remains sun, which is opposite of the mystic religions. Because in the mystic religions, all things come into one, and they're all just one thing. Three in one is very different than that idea of divine. Does that make sense?
Each piece of us gives to the masterpiece.
Yes.
You need
all those pieces. And they need to be unique, but they need to be tied together. So Paul says that you respond to this out of, like, this makes me whole to be brought into this, Paul feels. It makes him whole. And so he responds in a certain way. And this is what he's talking about for the first half of Ephesians 3 is, this is what happened to me when God gave me the mystery, when he showed me that this is what he was bringing me into, then I responded in the only way, really, that you could respond if you really took that all in. And he's going to differentiate between going, oh, yeah, that's nice, and fully participating in that. And Paul's going to show what he does is a full participation, and it's what he's going to call us into as well. So he says that he has used what he's been given, that wholeness that he's been giving, being in the perichoretic union, he's going to use that first to announce, to tell everyone about this. that there is a harmony of union that can go on. I don't know how much to get. There's a lot of philosophy under all of this. A lot of philosophy that's going on. Remember, this is the birthplace. Where Paul's from is the birthplace. Macedonia is the birthplace of all the philosophies. So, you know, all the philosophies we know, Socrates and Aristotle and all of those, come from here and from Paul's time. So there's a lot going on underneath here that he's talking about. But so that harmony, that's what the philosophy is always talking about. How do we harmonize life? Paul says the harmony of life is found in pericritic union with God and with each other. And I'm going to use that pericritic union that I've been given. I didn't acquire it. I didn't get it by my own power. I didn't get it by Satan's power of domination. But I was given it as a gift. And now I want to share it. So the question I asked you at the beginning, what did you beg people to do? Most of the things you said were things you love so much that you want others to share that love, right? That this is so fun. I know you would enjoy it so much. And so this is Paul. If you are fully participating in the pericritic union, there isn't anything that can stop it from coming out and saying, I want others to share this as well. So that it comes out, Paul says, by him using his preaching gift to tell other people. So when he says that, where does he say? Verse 8, to me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles. So this is the first thing that happens to him is he preaches to the Gentiles. When he says preach, remember, he's using himself as an example of what should happen with us if we're fully participating. So I want to be careful when he says preach, because a lot of times we use that and we say we all need to preach. And then we put it in a very narrow box, right? Mm-hmm. We think about preaching as standing up on a soapbox and telling everybody, which was Paul's gift. It's funny that it's Paul's gift because he's not a good speaker. So last night we had a visitor in our class, which is always a little awkward in a cohort. You have someone come in. And he was the first, we've had a couple of visitors, and he was the first visitor to actually participate in the discussion. And immediately I knew what his gift was. It was evangelism. Because we were first asked, okay, write down an elevator speech about what Romans is about. So we all started writing this. And he comes out, and he just like preached it. And you just sit back and go, okay, I know his gift is preaching. That he is an evangelist. I mean, there wasn't even any question. So Paul is saying, what comes out of me is I preach. But that's Paul's gift. So preaching here means that there is some invitation that comes out of you to come into the pericritic union because it's so great. It's not something you want to hoard. But your preaching may look very different than Paul's preaching. You may not be a preacher, but you may be someone who has the gift of service. So your preaching is going to look very different. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. He will get into that, obviously, in chapter 4, toward the end of 4, when he talks about using your gifts. But I wanted to clarify that so that when we think about preaching, it doesn't mean we all need to go out now on, you know, the corners and step up on a soapbox. And some of us can do that fantastically. And this guy last night, I thought, oh, he's not even in the class. And he just like, that's not my gift. So that's what he says. He's that the first thing is that I use my gift to like it just overflows. This union is so cool. It makes me whole. It makes you whole as well. I want to offer that to you. So that Paul says one of the things that happens when you're fully participating in pericritic union is that your gifts come out for others. They're not used for yourself. That's not anything new. That we use our talents and our abilities for ourselves, that's not good news, right? That's old news. That's what we always do. Paul says, when you participate in pericritic union, it actually comes out, it overflows towards others. That's the first thing that would happen. And when that flows out for others, it isn't a transactional flowing out. It isn't like, I'm going to use my gift to preach to you in whatever way it is so that I get something back from you. Paul says it just pours out. And he uses this language a lot, right? He uses it in 2 Timothy when he says, even if I've been poured out as a drink offering, which if we did 2 Timothy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know that was just a little thing he says. Even if I'm just poured out, it's for your benefit. It's not so I get something back for it. So we know it's not a transactional thing that he's talking about here. Interesting, there was an article, somewhere I have it, in the paper this week, that they've been doing a survey on kindness in the workplace. Has anybody seen this? So they've been interviewing people to see how important kindness is as opposed to domination, basically, in the workplace. And, you know, we really have built our businesses and our way of doing work life with dominating power. And so they're curious. People are going, well, what has happened to kindness in the workplace? So what, of course, I'm sure you're not surprised, everyone is saying, we want kindness. We don't want that dominating power. We want it. And I thought, well, that's good to say that people think that, you know, that kind of power is really what's good. But here's the interesting thing. So out of all the surveys that came up, there was no one that said dominating power is what we really need in business. Everyone said kindness. But the second thing they said is, but kindness should start with the people at top. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now think about that. They always think it should start somewhere else. Someone else should start it. Yeah. And what Paul's saying here is, if you're in pericritic union, you can't help but give it.
Well, it isn't to be received by them.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's about, what am I getting out of this? And Paul says, I've gotten wholeness already. I can't help but give it out. That's what happens when you participate.
But when it starts at the top, it filters down into the culture of the corporation.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, they've done studies one way or the other. And it's always ambiguous because if it starts from the bottom, it does the same thing. So it isn't of where it starts. It's more of, is it being done?
The more people that do it, the quicker it will take over.
Yeah. I wish I could. There's so much study done on that. It's really interesting to watch and see. And to see how much better business goes in the long run. So in the short term, not so much. It's the long term.
Operating under divine authority.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's what Paul's talking about. So he says that's one of the things that happens, has happened to me, when I have participated in what has been given to me. Secondly, he says, what also happens is in doing that, I reveal how the harmonized union works. In pouring out, I begin to show how that union works so that it gets to be seen. So that corporate indwelling of each other is a community invested in mutual indwelling. So just like we say in corporation, if one person is kind, eventually it gets kindness interwoven in here. And you begin to see how that works. And whole companies have been changed just by that one little thing of somebody being kind continually. And what that means is, you're kind when someone isn't kind to you, right? You just keep pouring out because in pericritic union, it's always about lifting the other. That's who you are in pericritic union. It's always about lifting the other. It isn't about a deal, right? It's not about a deal. As soon as I said that, I thought, Trump. It's not about a deal. It's not, if you're kind to me, I'll be kind to you. Or I'll be kind to you if you're kind to me. It's not that. In pericritic union, it's this pouring out and being open to whatever is being given.
Is Paul revealing how the union works by being in relationship with Gentiles?
Yes, he's definitely doing that. So he's revealing how things are, and what happens with Paul is, remember, he's traveling all around. As he's traveling to the Gentile churches, he's also collecting For what church?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, for the Jewish church, back in Jerusalem. So that he is beginning the work of this pericritic union between Jew and Gentile within that Roman world. So he's beginning to show that as he brings all of this together and lives this pericritic union. And that's important for us to know, too, that, that's happening in this time. So that he's not going individual. I think we often think about Paul. We talk about Paul's missionary journeys and which churches he started in this place and in this place and this place. But for Paul, he's not thinking, here's the Ephesus church, here's the Roman church, here's the Thessalonican church. He's thinking, here's the church. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. These are all connected, and they know about one another. And the way that Paul is working it is he's giving out and giving out, and so that they're beginning to see that there's these connections. So even we think, because especially Protestant, we think all these denominations, that's not how it was. These are all one church here. And he's showing them, I mean, I don't think there's a single Paul letter that he doesn't talk about the unity that is going on in the church here.
And they were all those letters were all shared with all the other churches.
So exactly.
It's the internet of the age.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And it's pretty amazing. And here's the interesting thing, too. At this time in history, this was probably up until the 18th to the 19th century, probably the easiest time for traveling. Because of all the maritime and the Roman Empire giving so much money, very easy. Like it's a 6-hour journey from Ephesus to Rome, just across the sea. I mean, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, we think about, oh, we'll drive 6 hours down for the day. So interesting that God uses this time when travel is so much easier than any time it has ever been, so that Paul's letters can go all over the place very, very quickly. In fact, a lot of times he will write a letter to some place he's going, and the letter will get there before he gets there. Because, he's stopping at other cities. So he's trying to show them that when you're participating in pericritic union, when you're fully participating, you're not only announcing to everyone, look at how cool this is, come on. You're showing them in very concrete ways, but then he adds something that should have, it should, even as we read it, and I wonder how you felt when you read it, blow us all out of the water. Not only is our purpose in joining that pericritic union so that we're full, not only is it so that we help others to come in and be full and whole, but what's the last thing that it does? Verse 10 and 11. Somebody read 10.
So that the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known through the church to the rulers and the authorities in the heavenly places.
Did anyone stop to think, what?
Yeah.
What? Our unity, our being built as a body of Christ, is actually showing off God's wisdom of who God is to the spiritual world. Commentators are not positive whether it means the entire spiritual world, angels and demons, or just demons. Whichever, our unity, our being participating fully in pericritic union shows the spiritual beings what God's wisdom is like, how amazing it is. And when we're displaying being fully in pericritic union, the demons get to see, and remember, the demons are working for disunity, they get to see how wise unity is. How amazing unity is, and how this is what God is working towards. We get to teach, basically, by our living in union with God and others, the demons, and probably the angels. Because the angels, as strong as they are, as close as they are to God in doing his bidding as messengers, they don't know what grace is until they see us in unity. Then they go, wow, that's what God's all about. Isn't that amazing? That we, ridiculously sinful people, show the angels what God is about. Our purpose is not just about being whole, and it's not even just about bringing others into wholeness. It's about displaying to the spiritual beings who God is. Now, if that isn't a big enough purpose, yeah, that's pretty big. I don't know what other purpose we could possibly want.
It's like too, they don't understand redemption and salvation because they've never experienced it.
Nope.
We have.
Right.
We should just be.
Right, exactly.
That's crazy.
And this is where I think it's amazing. And I think about Screwtape. Have any of you seen Screwtape? If you've seen it instead of just read it. Have any of you have seen it? Max McLean? Oh, my goodness.
Night and day.
It's a play. So Max McLean, British, he does it in Chicago every once in a while. You just realize that the demons, I mean, these are true beings, that they look and they see our unity, not our disunity. When they see that, they go, yep, yep, see? When they see our unity, when they see us working in pericritic union and living that, they're like, odd. That's what God is like. That's what they're missing. And the angels, they worship God because of that, because of what they see in us. To me, that just stops everything, to realize that when we choose that, when we choose to participate in that union, that we're literally on stage for the angelic beings.
So you don't think it's then a revelation to the prophets, your Abraham and all that they've already received that one
yep. thing? Yep. No, whenever they talk about rulers and authorities in the heavenly places, it's always the spiritual world. Always.
The spiritual word, not our. Okay.
Right. So it's always the spiritual. Remember that Paul is reminding us that the spiritual world and the physical world are coming together. And they're coming together in us. We're the place. So Paul's example here of when he is in pericritic union, he lets it overflow to others. He reveals how it works, but he also gets to be on display for the spiritual powers. And he does so when he comes boldly and confidently into the perichoresis, when he accesses the presence of the triune God, especially in the midst of tribulation. And here's where Paul gets down to brass tacks here. Because in tribulation, our weakness, our vulnerability in trials, that's the place where unity is seen most obviously. It's not the places of our strengths, it's the places of our weakness that the union becomes very obvious. In other words, tribulations are not something, a trouble to be annoyed at. They're an opportunity for practicing perichoresis, an opportunity to practice being in that union, because that's when it gets to be seen the most. There's nothing special or mysterious about people joining together for something fun or something powerful, right? That's common. That's what the world does. Oh, this is fun. Let's all get together and do it. But if someone says, let's go to the nursing home. Let's go. Bill and I are praying right now for a girl who's working with, this is so hard, for young girls, 13 years old. They're in the sex trafficking world. And I'm telling Bill about the girl that we're praying for, and you could see him. He's like, what? And our friend is working with these. So this is like, okay, let's all go in and let's be friends with their prostitutes. Oh, I don't even want to tell you the stories of them. It's that. It's like, all right, let's go. And Paul says, that union, that's the mysterious union. That's where we get to see the pericritic union even more. So that tribulations are not something to go, okay, let's just bear it and get out of here. It's the opportunity for the union to become really obvious to us, to the church, to the outside world, and to the spiritual world. That's the place where union gets to be seen most greatly. So that's what Paul's been doing, right? And in fact, particularly when he goes to these other churches and he works with them and he stays with them and he loves them. If you've read all the letters of Paul, you know that Paul has this just love for all the churches, right? But what you don't remember is that most of these churches were a mess. When he's talking to the Corinthian church, I mean, it's a mess. It's full. I mean, if you know anything about Corinth, you know, it's just full of the world. And he just sticks with them, no matter what, over and over and over again. They believe that Paul actually wrote 4 letters to the Corinthians, and we only have 2 of them. But they were a mess, and he just, you know, goes on with them and on with them. That's where the union is seen more clearly. So he's doing all this, and he's saying, this is what has happened to me. He doesn't say, I have just persevered so that I could do this and show you guys. He's saying, this is what's flowing out of me. And he wants us to participate in. So that when we get to verse 14, he starts with a prayer, right? And he says, so 13 is, I don't know if you noticed that verse 1, he never finished his sentence. So verse 1 says, for this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Christ Jesus, for the sake of you Gentiles, if indeed you have, and then he goes on this big parenthesis, right? So 13 is the pickup of that. If, for this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner, for the sake of you Gentiles, don't lose heart in tribulation, in my tribulation, for they are your glory. You get to see perichoresis in action there. You get to see it. You get to be invited into it. You get to see that it's displaying who God is for the world and for the heavenlies. So that's his parentheses there. And then he says, for this reason, I bow my knee before the Father. So he goes into prayer here. This is really interesting. So it says he kneels to pray. And I bet every one of you just said, well, of course, right? He kneels to pray. That's not how you prayed. You pray standing up. So in all the world, whether it's in Judaism, Christianity, or any of the mystical worlds, you pray standing up. You don't pray kneeling. Occasionally, one will kneel. And you kneel for one reason. Think about this. Remember we talked about worship, when you come in to worship a king. You're coming in to hear him, right? But when you really, really want something, think about all the old movies. What happens?
Get down on your knees.
You beg. That's what Paul's doing here. So his position, his bodily position, tells us how much he wants us to participate fully in pericritic union with God. I so much want it. And it's interesting, he doesn't right away go, he's writing this letter to the Ephesians, but he first wants them to know, the first place I'm going to go to beg is to God. Because it's going to only be through God's Spirit that you're actually going to come into it anyway. But he wants to go to God and beg on our behalf. He thinks it's the most wonderful thing, and he wants to beg that we fully participate in this. And so he gets on his knees. And of course, when it's on his knees, if I weren't injured in my knee, I wanted to flop down and just beg. And it would be like, Linda, please. Okay. So it's this very strong position. It's not a, oh, it's not this, oh, please. It's this very strong position. Please, God, give this to them. Bring them to a place that they fully participate. Remember, he's talking here already to believers. And that's important for you to know, because you would think Paul's going, well, they're already believers. Why do I need to beg for them to participate in union? Because Paul's going to delineate here between saying, oh, yeah, I want to be there, and fully participating in that union. Not just a, I touch it every once in a while, but a full living it. And so he's going to beg God for that. His desire is that they would participate like he has. And not because he thinks he's great, but because of the experience he's had in participating in this. Like, this is an experience I want everyone to have. In fact, there's a point where Paul, not in Ephesians, but where Paul says, if only my people, the Jews, would participate like this, I would give up my salvation for them. That's how much Paul desires this. That's how much he's begging that they do that. But I love that he's begging them first through God, so that they understand how big this is. But participating in the pericritic union actually means practicing it. Because they're already participating, but not fully. It isn't a, this is my entire life. It needs practice for the purpose of a permanent dwelling, rather than a keeping in touch. So we all have people that we kind of keep in touch with, right? We write them a Christmas card. But would you say you participate in their life? You call them friends, right? And yet there's a huge distance. Like, every once in a while I'll talk to them or I'll write them. And then, you know, when someone says, so what do you know about so-and-so? And you think, oh, not much. Don't know much. That's the difference Paul is saying, is you've come to Christ, you've received the life he wants to give you, but it's kind of like, every once in a while it's nice to figure out what's going on here. He wants them to experience a let them move in with you kind of thing. He wants them to carve out space in their own life so that God can come in and move into their life, rather than temporarily making space in your day. So it's as if you had a friend who says, you know, I really need a place to stay. And you say, oh, you can come for a week, or you can come for a day or two. You know, until you find something, that's fine. What's that difference between come and stay as long as you need? What's the difference for you in that?
First, you have control. Second, you give up all control.
There you go. Convenience. Yeah. So first, you have control. Like, it's only for a few days.
It's a limited investment.
It's a very limited investment. And it's hardly really an investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to make you feel good. But this come and stay as long as you want changes things.
It's more like sacrificial giving.
Completely sacrificial giving.
You know, the other thing is gracious, though. It's the other is, I expect you to get on your feet. And the other is, I have no expectation that you're going to. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And there's a real shift for that, for all of us. Several years ago, and most of you know this story, several years ago, you know, Liz is always working with refugees, and there was a point where some refugees came over that were classified, so they couldn't go to any home. So Liz said, so Mom and Dad, can we have this family come and live with us, you know? And when World Relief, this is when she worked with World Relief, when World Relief brings them over, the first family that gets them, they only stay a week, and then they get, so that's what I'm assuming. So they come, and of course they can't speak English, and they're confidential, so nobody can really know that they're here. Wow. They've got little kids. And,
wow, wow, wow.
And so I'm sure we could do this. Now, remember, we're introverts, so this is a big deal for us. And we come in, and we can do this. A week passes, and I'm saying to Lissa, where's their housing? Well, their housing fell through. We don't know when we're going to get housing for them. And I'm beginning to panic. I've got three little kids. They're all in one room. Three little kids, two parents. They don't speak English. I mean, it has completely disrupted my life. And now I'm having to switch from, oh, sure, I can do this. I'm a big girl. I can do this. To, what? When will you get housing? We don't know. The switch. And I will say that it was hard for me. That was really hard. Like, I think they end up staying 2 or 3 weeks. And at the end, I said, Lisa, you've got to get them a place. Now, they were wonderful people. There was nothing. It's just now it's my life is out of control, right? I don't have control. And there's funny stories. Like, by this time now, they want to help. So they see Bill going out to mow the lawn. So the man wants to help mow the lawn. And Bill said, all right. Well, they've never mowed a lawn. Oh, that was so funny. So there's no such thing as back and forth. It's just, it was hilarious. Anyway, all that to say, to have someone move into your life is going to take daily encounters to figure out what they want, what they need, right? It's not, so one morning we wake up early, they're gone. The entire family is gone. And remember, they're not supposed to even, you know, they're from a country that they could be, yeah. We don't know where they are. We have no idea. They had walked up to the 7-Eleven to get milk for the baby. Well, first of all, we have never drank milk here. My kids are allergic. So it never even occurred to me. And I couldn't communicate with them. But those were the things I needed to be able to communicate, right? There has to be a daily communication with, what do you need for living? What delights you? What would you have fun? We took them to a movie. Luckily, Wall-E was out.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, how perfect.
It was perfect, because there's no words. And very, yes.
Yeah. Their idea
of America. I didn't think about that.
So we had to switch from temporarily making space, no big deal, to, okay, now you're living here. And then we began to, so they began to make some meals. They would make kimchi. And, you know, so we took them to the grocery store. So now we're making space. But in making space for them, you make space for them. What do you like to do? What do you want to eat? They're no longer a guest, right?
Now you're treating them like kin.
Now you have to treat them like kin. There's a big difference there. This is what Paul is calling us to do with the Pericritic Union. It's not as guests. It's not that God gets to come and live next door to you. Because that would be nice, wouldn't it? Anytime you need him, you just, you know, knock on the door. But he's not here every minute of your day. And this is what Paul is saying. This is the difference here, the Ephesians. I want you to experience what it's like to have him live here. And you making space for him. So he says that. So he prays this for them, that they would receive their identity from the Father. So he says, everyone's identity is from the Father, but my prayer is that they would receive that. In other words, that they would dwell in the Father. So remember that Pericritic Union is all about indwelling. Us dwelling in God, God dwelling in us. And so that's what his prayer is here, is receive our identity from the Father, knowing that he alone is our source of food, of life, and that we're receiving it from him. When I dwell in him, I want him to know my needs. I want him to see my needs. So I will reveal my needs to him. I'll uphold him. I'll honor. I want him to uphold me, rather, when I dwell in him. And every time I do think it's useful if you get some kind of a picture in your mind of what that looks like when you dwell in God. My picture, and I know this is the weird one, but I've told you before, my picture is actually getting inside of a horse. So you know how Indians would do that? Mm-hmm. When a horse would die and they needed to be warm, they would get inside a horse or a cow or whatever. I guess they didn't have cows. What would have been?
Buffalo.
Bison. To get inside of that and get the warmth from that just dead. But God is alive, right? So that's my picture. Now, you may not like that picture. Think of another picture of you getting inside of God, that you're in there. Because when I'm in there, then I'm getting from him. I'm getting my nourishment. I'm getting my warmth. I'm getting my life from him. That feeling of, and for me, when I think about that feeling of, oh, it's so good to be here. Maybe your picture is of being a little kid and just culling up into the lap of your mom or dad. That, oh, it just...
How about being a mom and cuddling up with your kid?
Yeah. Right? I do think we go back to that feeling of just feeling so safe, right? And so relaxed. Mm-hmm. That idea, and that's what Paul is trying to get. Make sure that your source of life is God, that you're dwelling in him. I want you to dwell in him, he says. And then I want the opposite to happen. Let the Spirit strengthen you from within. Let the Spirit dwell in you. Because remember, pericritic union is all about mutual indwelling. You dwelling in God and God dwelling in you. And that's that place where you're making space. Allowing his life to be in me the same way my life is in him. And this is really radical. We don't talk about this a lot. We talk about the Spirit being in us, but we don't talk about what is that like? What is it like to make room? We had books here and we had to shove a lot of stuff away. But I think the picture of letting someone come and live with you is making space, completely rearranging your life to suit their needs and their desires.
Joe,
yeah.
Can I just say, I had this experience several years ago. We were going through a really tough time, and we were. I needed a place to live, and with my daughter. And as you are talking, it was just such a beautiful picture of this family that we didn't even know took us in. And I just remember watching her as she just cleaned her refrigerator and threw things away. Got rid of stuff so I had space. She went through her cabinets and did the same thing. She took things out of a room to give me space and did the same thing for my daughter. It was just, it's like that picture, she taught me what it really meant to make space for somebody else. It was just a terrible time we were going through, but it was the most beautiful picture of God.
Right.
And it still blows my mind when I think about what they did for us.
Yeah.
And it was so natural for them.
And that is a beautiful picture of what it should look like within the church, that we're actually making room for one another. It's not that we're having you over for dinner. That we're making room for you in our lives so that no matter what happens, you know you have a place there. And that me letting you in means I do get rid of stuff. And not just physical stuff, but that sometimes happens. I get rid of stuff, which is, I think, what Lent is all about. Mm-hmm. I get rid of stuff so that I can have others indwell me. So that I can have God indwell me from being, have others dwell in me.
And it also taught me so that I felt confident to do it.
Yes.
We just kind of did that.
Exactly.
And an opportunity. It was like, I think about the verse, encourage one another on to love and good deeds.
Yep.
It was like,
that's what he means.
That's exactly what happened with me.
Yes.
And it taught me so that I could feel confident to do it.
Right. Right.
But, yeah.
And that's exactly what Paul says is, when you are in pericritic union, it teaches others how to be in pericritic. It demonstrates this is how pericritic union works, is this beginning mutual indwelling. And it does need to be mutual. And that's one of the things we often forget. So that when I make space for you, I also let you make space for me. So when we had the Kims here, once we got to that point, it was not only do I make space for you, but then I let that you make space for me to let them have, you know, it changed from being the hostess to being kin. Oh, it's your turn to make dinner tonight, rather than I'm making you dinner, you know. And it was hard actually to go to the grocery store and to not pay for it all, right? That allowing that, and I remember there being this, you know, tug of war, and you're thinking, but they don't have anything, but they want to make dinner for us, and we're not letting them if we pay. So it's that idea, and that's what Paul is saying: is I want you to start doing this with one another, but I also want you to do this with God. Make space for God, and find out what His desires are. Communicate with Him. What delights you? And it starts making space for His delights, His desires, His will, and the other way around as well. So that as we begin to do that, Paul says, we begin to be knitted together. Now we can't see where one is giving and one is taking, right? Now it's this. Now it's this. It's that. And that's why he says, in doing that, you making space and letting them make space for you, you begin to be rooted into that soil, right? Grounded in love. And when he says that, you know, don't go back to all your ideas of what love is. Go back to pericritic union. This is love. That's the definition of love. Now you're starting to get rooted in love. You're starting to, this is where you feel home now, is in that kind of union. Kristen.
So when you don't, you said it should be mutual. Do you think there's a bigger problem with, because I plenty of times don't feel like there's a mutual thing there. Do you think it's more me not letting someone be mutual? Or do you think some people just don't take the time to be mutual? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think it's both. Oh. But what do you think is probably more likely?
I feel like,
no, that's why I'm asking.
Maybe I'm not being genuinely making space. Uh-huh. And therefore that person's still closed off to me.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of my sister. You know, like, am I truly in every way opening myself up? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's hard to take charity, though.
Yep.
I mean, it really is. So the person who is coming into your home, mm-hmm. they have an independent spirit and wanting to provide for their family, and now they can't. And mm-hmm. so that's, I mean, it's both ways. Just like you say, it's both ways. Because it's hard for people to do that.
Yeah, I think it is. And I do think, Kristen, I think here in Western civilization, I think we tip a little bit more toward, we're not as willing to let others open themselves up for us, because it doesn't, that feels like we're helpless, right? We don't like that.
It feels like we're equal with them and we want to be better.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. But it definitely goes both ways. And there's definitely times where they don't want to open to us. But see, it's interesting this. Paul says that, that has nothing to do with whether you continue to give out, right? You just continue to give out. But that rooting, when you're beginning to be rooted in God's pericritic union, you begin to grow so that pretty soon you're not even noticing so much that, because what happens when you put a plant in soil and the roots actually start to take hold in that soil, what happens to the plant itself?
It flourishes.
It starts growing, right? And it gets bigger and it gets more beautiful and it grows and grows and grows. It grows enough so that there become more roots and there's more ability to take in the nutrients that are needed to grow bigger and stronger. And we'll look at what happens even after that, because there's still more to go with that. But these things apply both individually with our relationship with Christ, but also our relationship with one another, so that these are working both at the same time. Carolyn.
I kind of look at, there's a gift of giving, and many people have a lot of gifts of giving. Mm-hmm. But you know, I learned something. There's a gift to receive.
Yes.
Too. And
yep.
It's hard to receive when you've been helping others and doing this and that, and then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. you can't do this mm-hmm. and that.
But that's why I say tribulation, times of weakness, are the best times that we get to see union. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So, 'cause that's when we need to receive.
So when you're trying to be in relationship with someone who doesn't seem to be receiving their identity from the Father, my part in that is to be vulnerable with that person mm-hmm. and yeah. give them an opportunity to meet one of my needs,
yep.
maybe?
Yep, exactly. So that means that sometimes we have to actually ask, right? And we have to ask somebody who we're not sure will give. Because that's the, and that's really.
Or not give the way we want.
Right, exactly. Can you help me in this way? Or can you just help me? And to be able to receive whatever they want to give. So it becomes a place of huge vulnerability. But that's what pericritic union is. It's not about me going out and getting what I think I need. It's about me receiving what's being given. And being open to that. And even asking for that. I want us to get to the practice of it, so let's see if we can zip through here. The experience of pericritic union, then, it does have to be in community. So you can, and I've said this enough times, I hope that you, that's one thing you remember, is you can't have pericritic union with just you and God. That's just not a possibility. It happens in community. And community is where we get to concretely, tangibly experience it. So community is necessary. Christ's body is necessary for us to experience that union. And we get to experience the different dimensions of pericritic union. In other words, Paul was able to experience all of his life from the dimension of the heavenlies, from the spiritual realm, rather than simply being confined to looking at everything from the earthly realm, which is how he starts with chapter 3, right? I, a prisoner of Christ. He can see that this is, he can see it from a different dimension because he's in pericritic union. But he says it also, it goes beyond knowledge. It goes beyond, and he's talking against the mystical religions because they were always about what, it's only about the mind. It's only, and we would say, it's all, just as long as you believe. We talk about that, right? It's just about your belief. Paul said, no, it's not actually. It's not just about belief. It's actually about being, participating in this union. It's just not believing that it's there, that it's available, but it's participating in that. It's not just belief. And that when you participate in it fully, it actually fills you to overflowing. So that flower we talked about, rooted, once those roots start to take hold of the soil and they start to grow, the flower itself grows, the plant grows, lots more leaves, lots more flowers. But what happens after it flowers? It fruits, right? It, before it dies, it produces seeds, right? In some way. And it's really fun to actually go and try to look for the seeds in any plant you have because all plants have them. And you look for the seeds and you realize the seeds drop somewhere and they fall and they create others. So that you being rooted and grounded in perichoretic union, in love, produces seeds in other places, that drop in other places. And so that you share that vulnerable access of union that Paul is talking about. We don't stay. In other words, we cannot think about community as a closed place. And often I think we think about that. We think about church as the church building we go to, or as the church community we're involved in, and we just think about it like this. Paul does not look at church that way. Church is the body of Christ, wherever it is. It's got an arm over here and a leg over here and ears and eyes over here and here. And he calls us to this, and in Romans he's going to call you even further, to stop thinking about it like that. It's not closed. If it's closed, it's not in pericritic union. So it should never look like this little closed social club. That's why I always... Sometimes I kind of cringe when people's idea of inviting people to pericritic union is inviting them to their church. Because they're inviting them to a very closed community. And no one feels comfortable there. You feel very out of it. it's invite to relationship. Mm-hmm. And then in relationship, they'll want to do what you want to do, right? So very different. So what Paul is saying is, all of this, when I'm fully participating in perichoretic union, the result of participation in perichoretic union is worship. That's what happens. That's what comes out of that. When the mystery of the new humanity is practiced and participated in, we see the new temple being built. Renewed worship is done in you being involved in perichoretic union. That's where the worship of God is being done. That's where heaven and earth are actually being restored in you. You individually, but more so, you in the body of Christ. You living, indwelling one another in the body of Christ. So that when Jesus talks about, remember he talks about the tear this temple down in 3 days, I'll build it up. Of course he's talking about his own body, physical body, but even more so he's talking about the body of Christ that he's going to be building, that he's restoring in the new humanity that he creates. So he says that his power accomplishes things beyond our imagination. Because we think about very solid things. Oh, I have the power to not dominate. But what does that power do? It actually creates new life. That we actually get to partner with God in creating new life. My dwelling in him and him dwelling in me produces fruit, like that flower. Because when I'm rooted in that union, I produce seeds. I don't force the seeds to come out. I don't say, now I have to have love, now I have to have patience. It comes as I'm participating in the union. Letting God dwell in me, letting me dwell in God. And he then receives glory. You can kind of read that. I want to go to the practical application. I just want to jump there. Because this is what we're going to be doing here. What Paul is going to introduce from here on in is that there needs to be a very intentional practice of perichoretic living. And you might ask, well, why don't we just whenever we think about it, why don't we be in union with God? Well, partly because of the way we make decisions. So there's a new book out called Thinking Fast and Slow. Does anybody look at, so these are business books mostly.
What is the book?
Thinking Fast and Slow. Thinking Slow and Fast are one of the two. And it talks about how we make decisions. So we actually make decisions most often intuitively because it's the fastest way to make a decision by our intuition. And so it becomes our default. It's how we make most decisions. That's called fast thinking. It's really fast to make decisions intuitively. And what they have found is that we make pretty good, wise, correct decisions when we do it intuitively. If when we do so, we've actually unknowingly based it on information we already have. In other words, I will make a good decision by intuition if I've already had experience with a particular situation in some way. If I have some information about this, then I will intuitively make a better decision. Because it's really based on fact. It's just that it's not obvious to me right now. I feel like this is the right way to go. But it's if it's a good decision and it's a correct decision, it's because it's actually been based on prior information that I have in my brain. The times when we make decisions by intuition that are poor choices, that are poor decisions, that are incorrect decisions, are times when we intuit it without having had any prior experience or information or knowledge about that particular situation. The problem is we aren't aware of either of those. So we intuit all the time. Oh, I think I should make this for dinner. I think I should go this way on the road. We don't know that our brain has this stored information or not. So we don't know that. Which means that when I make decisions, if I want to make decisions that are good and according to truth, that I better have some backup information behind that, right? Some backup experience behind that. Which is the reason why I need to practice pericritic union, so that when I come to a certain situation, I already have experience with pericritic union, and therefore I'm making my decision based on what God is doing rather than the situation. Mm-hmm. In other words, so let's say that I'm downtown Chicago and I'm not sure which way to go and I have to make a decision. I think I'll go west. Now, if it's a good decision, it's probably been based on the fact that either I've been here before, I have seen a map of this, I've heard someone talking about it, I know Chicago well enough to know it's on a grid, something like that, so I have that. And I make a good decision. If, perhaps, I'm in Cleveland, I've never been in Cleveland, I have never heard anyone talk about Cleveland, I've never seen a map of it, but I still have to make a decision, I'll think, I think that looks like a good way to go. And the way I made that decision was, I actually let my flesh talk to me into it. I actually saw something that spoke to my flesh. Something that looked open or safe or beautiful or... But I don't know that I'm making that decision. I just think we talk about this all the time, right? We talk about mother's intuition all the time. In reality, mother's intuition is that I've already had an experience with this baby or this kid. I know this kid. So I have this intuition that I think he might be in trouble right now. But it's based on actual stuff you have in your brain. So that when I come into a situation and I have not been practicing pericritic union and I go, oh, what does God want me to do? Oh, I think God wants me to do this. We are going to make intuitive decisions all the time. And if I've not been practicing pericritic union, I will say things like, oh, I really feel God wants me to do this. And yet they'll be based on the situation, how the situation makes me feel, how it makes my flesh feel, rather than what is God doing in this situation. Do you see the difference here? It's a big difference. And we have the ability to practice pericritic union so that when we come to a situation, we have experience that God is actually doing things, that he's redeeming us here, that he's restoring us, that he's giving us choices. So that practicing pericritic union makes a big difference in how I make decisions throughout the day. And that's what Paul is leading us here into. He's praying to God that we would experience the pericritic union so that we have backup information so that we're living in pericritic union more and more often. Does this make sense to you? Okay, so, as always, we're out of time. So, again, we're not going to use our notebooks. But I want you to think about how you're narrating your stories. We've been talking about how you're narrating your stories. And I'm just going to give you two examples of things you can practice. Remember that practice eventually makes a habit, right? But what's the minimum amount of time that a habit is formed? 30 days. So 30 days is the minimum amount that you can actually form a habit. Guess how many days we have until Easter? It's like 32. We have just enough time to form a habit of living, participating fully in pericritic union. So I'm going to give you two. You can come up with your own. Here are two ways that I think that you can practice that. First, the dwelling in him. How can I practice dwelling in Christ? Getting into that horse and getting all my nourishment and warmth from him. How can I practice that? I think this is a classic way. If you've been in a liturgical church, you've done this. Where are my hour of prayer? Do you know what those are? What that is? Okay. Divine hours. If you've been in a liturgical church, you know this, that you pray the Lord's Prayer every day. So I'm going to walk you through it. What does God say? What does Jesus say when he teaches the disciples to pray? He says, whenever you pray, say this. Mm-hmm. And we as Protestants go, oh, that's not how you're supposed to pray. And I think, why do we always want to twist Christ's words? Pray every day, the Lord's Prayer. Uphold him as the place you want to dwell. So let me go through the Lord's Prayer, praying it as saying to him, making a commitment to him, I want to dwell in you today. So, I'm going to go through this really fast. Our Father. When I say our Father, it signals a couple things. Our. It signals that I'm in paracritic union with others, right? I am in union with others, which means I'm submissive to the cohort. I'm submissive to that connection. I'm not here on my own. It's not just me and God, which is how we always start our prayers, right? In the morning, it's always about you and me, God. And Jesus says, whenever you pray, say, our Father. You're in paracritic union with others. So this saying the Lord's Prayer every day, thinking through this, God, I'm making a commitment that I'm in paracritic union with others. And when I say Father, it signals that Trinitarian part of the cohort, that God, me, and others are in this together, but it's also the Trinity of God the Father. I can have connection with God the Father because I am in the Son and because the Spirit is in me. So just saying our Father brings you to the point where saying, God, you've allowed me to be in paracritic union with you. I want to be there. I want to dwell in you. I want to dwell in that paracritic union. Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. He's in heaven, but so am I. Paul just told us that, right, in Ephesians 1. He has seated us in the heavenly places, but I'm there because he seated me. You've brought me into your realm. And I belong there because you have brought me into there. And holy is that place. This is the place and the only place where I'm going to get my wholeness. So that when I'm praying that, it is God, I want to dwell in you because I know this is the place where I'm going to get fed for life. This is the one place that I will be fed for life. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as in heaven. In paracritic union is always about me holding up the other. And this is me saying, your kingdom, your will. It's when he moves into my house, I ask him, what's your desires? What do you delight in? That's me holding him up. Your delight, your will be done. So that heaven and earth in me can be seen together. I allow the restoration of heaven and earth by letting him dwell in me, by giving him space and asking, what's your desire here? Give us this day our daily bread. Father, you decide what to feed me and when to feed me. We're going to come to you today to let you feed me. I'm not going to go and decide what I need today. I want to let you decide. I'm in you. You decide what I need to eat. And this, of course, affirms Christ's reversal about our choice of food from last week. And I love the Lord's Prayer because you can always bring it back to every teaching in any of the letters. They're always talking back about this. The daily bread, always going back to Christ reversing our choice of foods. Forgive us our debts or trespasses, whichever you say. How many of you say debts? How many trespasses? Oh, I'm so glad to see that. Okay. Oh, sins. Okay. Really modern. Forgive us, God, when we refuse to eat what you have given us. Forgive us when we refuse to eat what you've given us, because we're going all the way back to what is it? We always decide what we think is for life. And as we forgive our debtors or those who trespass against us or those who sin against us, let us help us to forgive those who refuse. And this is Kristen's question, who refuse to mutually dwell in coordinative relationship with us. But as soon as we say that to God, Lord, help us to forgive those who don't want to mutually dwell within us. It comes up and to say, did I have any part in that? Did I refuse to eat what God gave me by refusing to mutually indwell another? So the question here isn't like, we're going to do this, God. It's really a question, Have I refused? Lead us not into, and I put this in here so it makes you understand this a little bit, falling in temptation. Remember, we're going back to Jesus in the wilderness, in the temptation. Lead us so that we don't fall when temptation comes. A commitment then is I'm saying, God, I want to stay in you. So if this is a daily verbal commitment to dwell in him, this lead us so that we don't fall into temptation. Say, I want to make a commitment here that I want to stay in you. I want to stay dwelling in you. I want you to tend me today. I don't want to separate from you. I don't want to use Satan's power today to dominate, to manipulate my situation, to get out of tribulation. I want to affirm Christ's reversal of throwing ourselves at our own desires, that throwing off the temple thing, that pleasing our own eyes. So this is a plea to God. This is what I want to do. This morning, right now, I want to do this. And I love, but deliver us from evil. If we try to pull away, I'll let you pull me back. For thine alone is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Father, your perichoretic being is the place where I receive my wholeness. My wholeness of being, the power to live in that wholeness, and my purpose for being. This affirms Christ's reversal of taking our own kingdom, of being wise and being our own God. Rather, we say to God, I will wait for you to give me the kingdom you have by dwelling in you. That's practice number one, to dwell in him. If every day you practice going through the Lord's Prayer, thinking those things to him, I want to make a commitment to dwell in you and get my nourishment from you. And then the practice for me dwelling in him is basically what Paul talks about is the obedience of faith. But remember that the Old Testament has no word for obedience. Anytime you see obey in the Old Testament, that's not the word. The word is listen. It's always listen. And listening means I take in what he has to give me. I let him dwell in me. Because listening leads to that participation in perichoresis, right? Listening says, I'm open. What do you have for me? I want to hear it. Just like anyone living in your home, you have to communicate as to what their needs and desires are. I can't assume I know. So I have to make space to hear. This will mean for the next 30 days, if you want to practice this, that you actually slow down. So that each situation, you listen for what God is trying to tell you. Every situation you come upon. So that the situations I come upon, if I have no experience with the perichoretic union, I'm going to make a decision based on the situation, on my flesh. But I want to know what God is doing here. I want to be in union enough to know that. So, my practice, this is a suggestion. My practice suggestion would be every situation you come upon this week, this day, ask God the questions. Ask God the questions about agency. Ask God the questions about relationship and redemption and victim hero. Mm-hmm. All of those. So that you say, God, how do I know that I have a choice in this situation? And what do you hear him say? Ephesians 1, he says, I have given you every spiritual blessing. I've given you the power. You don't have to use the dominating power. You can use perichoretic union power to give out, to uphold others. You can use that instead. God, how do I know that this is about this situation is about relationship? God says, I've chosen you to be in my family. Everything I do will be to affirm that and draw you closer to me. Everything is about being in relationship. And not just with me, but with my whole family. God, how do I know that this is about restoration, that you're actually using this situation for restoration for me. God says, I've redeemed you. I have bought back the unity you need to be whole. And you're privy to what I'm doing. Why I'm making you whole is to restore you so that you can restore the whole world. That's what I'm doing all the time. So that every situation I'm asking these questions, and God's answering by what he told you in Ephesians. And that's how you're listening. You ask, God, is this about relationship? Yes, I've made you. I've chosen you to be my own child. Is this about, so that all of those first three, it's definitely about. So when you're narrating your story, it's not just about one of them. It's about all of them. And then I can go the opposite. How do I know I'm not a victim or I'm not a hero? God says, because in Christ I've made you alive. So you're not a hero because it's Christ who's made you alive. But you're not a victim because you're alive. You're no longer bound to your agreement to be independent. Because God in Christ has raised you, you're no longer confined to the world's values. So you're not a victim. You do have choice. God in Christ has seated me, so I no longer have to strive to make a place of power for myself. You're already seated in the place of power. If you combine these two as practices, praying the Lord's Prayer, giving yourself to dwell in him today, and then every situation that you come across, ask questions. God, how do I know that this is about relationship? How do I know that this is about, that I have the power to choose a different way of living? How do I know that this is about redemption, that you're restoring me? And listen to what he says, which is why I had us memorize last week. In Christ, we are blessed, we are chosen, we are redeemed, we are privy, we are heirs, right? And I have been raised, I have been made alive, I've been raised, I've been seated. Those eight things, those are always the answer to what God is doing here. Those are always the answer. But I need to practice hearing that in every situation. And I practice hearing that and practice hearing that. When it becomes a habit, I will intuitively make a decision about, oh, I've got a choice here. I can actually choose to uphold the other rather than be about me. This is about relationship here. And it begins to be a habit so that you begin to see, like Paul saw, that he was a prisoner of Jesus Christ and not of Rome. He's not a victim. God is giving him choices. God is giving him the participation in the pericritic life. So much more, but hopefully that'll give you an idea. It's just a... I'll put that out there as a Lenten practice. So you have 33 days, which I thought was funny. I wrote, oh, a habit takes 30 days, and then I thought, I wonder how many days we have left. Just enough. Father, thank you that you always plan it so that we have access and invitation into participating fully in that pericritic union. Father, this week I pray that we would be reminded that so many times we want you to live next door, but we're not quite sure we want you to move in. Father, I pray that this week we would make room, that we would commit to having you dwell in us and us dwell in you, that we would share our lives with you, that we would be vulnerable and open, but that we would do it also in community. Father, that we might demonstrate to others that pericritic union is the wholeness, but even more that we might be excited that we're on stage for all of the spiritual powers that exist, that we have an amazing connection with you to be able to be co-rulers in the restored heaven and earth. In Jesus' name, amen.
So I can smell the